The title Greatest Living Actress has long been affixed to the name of Meryl Streep. She would be the first to tell you that no such thing exists. But she is a movie star, an American treasure, one of those rare actors whose career has not only endured but thrived over many, many decades. But years earlier, as a young woman learning her way, all that fame and success seemed very far away and far from inevitable. Michael Shulman, a contributor and arts editor at The New Yorker magazine, tells the story of Streep's early rise in his new book, Her Again, Becoming Meryl Streep. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Michael Shulman to the roundtable this morning. Michael, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the title of the book and how you came to it. It's a very cool story, I think.
Oh, yeah. Well, the title, Her Again, comes from Meryl's Oscar speech from 2012 when she won for The Iron Lady. She got up on stage and she said,
"When they called my name, I had this feeling I could hear half of America going, oh, no. Oh, come on, why? Her. Again, you know? But whatever."
And so I thought it would be funny to just use her joke about herself.
But it does tell us a lot about her, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, she's always been a little bit wary of the hype surrounding her and the idea of celebrity. You know, I think that she, as an actress, her first priority has always been her craft and her characters. And the fact that she got famous and has been an international celebrity for four decades, it's almost an annoyance to her.
What brought you to the project? What did you ultimately want to explore in this biography?
Well, so my book is focused on her rise in the 1970s. It's really about how Meryl Streep spent her 20s and how she learned about acting, discovered acting, and rose to fame in Hollywood. And the reason is that I, first of all, I was a huge admirer of hers, but I didn't really know much about how she got to be this greatest living actress figure. You know, it just, she seems sort of frozen as that person for so long. And I wanted to go back and explore the forces that shaped her and what her coming of age as an artist was like. And it just so happened that coincided with New York in the 70s. It's an era I love. And I just sort of wanted to create a portrait of her as a young woman in that era.
So she went to Vassar College and then the Yale School of Drama. What do we know about her times there and her rise as an actress within the programs in those institutions?
Yeah, well, they were vastly different experiences from each other. So in high school, she was a kind of cheerleader, homecoming queen, popular girl, and was very preoccupied with looking pretty and appealing to the boys on the football team. You know, as she puts it, she was sort of pursuing very shallow goals, but with extreme perseverance and talent, actually, for sort of pretending she was someone else, as we know now. But at Vassar, she was there in the late 60s, early 70s. And when she got there, it was an all-female school still. And she said that experience just completely opened her up to an authentic sense of self. You know, she started discovering James Joyce and taking Italian and making, you know, her first deep female friendships with her classmates and just sort of opened her mind a lot. And at the same time, she discovered serious acting. You know, she had been in High School Musicals, but she was suddenly cast as Miss Julie in the Strindberg play Miss Julie, which is a very serious, complicated part. And it was the first serious play she had ever seen, much less been the star of. So it just completely changed her life. And then at Yale, she went, you know, she started figuring, okay, I should really study this. I can do this for a living. So she went to the Yale School of Drama, which was, you know, really prestigious program. And I had always been interested in that period of the drama school's history because she was there at the same time as Sigourney Weaver and the playwrights Wendy Wasserstein and Christopher Durang. It's just this golden age of the school. But it turns out, as I learned, everyone there was completely miserable. They were so stressed out. There was so much competition. It was such a pressure cooker. And even though Meryl was, you know, at the top of her class, the kind of star student who was put in every single play, she was so beleaguered by the attention she was getting, by being singled out. She actually developed an ulcer. It was a really dark experience for her.
So then it's the mid-70s. She's graduated from Yale. She heads to New York, and in a rather short period of time, she has back-to-back Broadway plays, a Tony nomination, and two roles in Shakespeare in the Park. Not bad.
Oh, yeah. Her first year in New York City theater was just incredible. She found a home, an artistic home at the Public Theater, which, you know, includes Shakespeare in the Park, and Joe Papp, the legendary producer, just kind of plucked her out of obscurity and put her on stage at Lincoln Center and at Shakespeare in the Park, and she just nailed it. She played completely different characters. You know, she was doing what we know she can do now, which is just be anything. You know, she was in the Tennessee Williams play where she played a kind of Anna Nicole Smith-esque character, a kind of a sluggish redneck woman on a porch, and just it was a funny performance. She just impressed everyone, and it was an incredible run right out of the gate. But she had no interest in being a movie star and no belief that she would ever be in movies.
So what brought her to that direction after having such success in New York, having such success in the theater world? What brought her to Hollywood?
Well, in a way, it was kind of an accident of fate, and it had a lot to do with John Cazale, the actor she was dating at the time. He's mostly known as Fredo from the Godfather movies, and they met doing Shakespeare in the Park in 1976, and they moved in together. They had this passionate love affair. They lived in Tribeca in John's loft, and only a year into their relationship, John was diagnosed with terminal lung cancer, just really a devastating diagnosis. And at the same time, they were both starring on Broadway, and both of them were offered a part in the movie The Deer Hunter. And John already had a movie career from The Godfather, Dog Day Afternoon, and he really wanted to work with Robert De Niro, his co-star from The Godfather Part II. And Meryl was a little more skeptical about her part in that movie. She sort of saw her as a kind of the one, kind of the token woman in a man's movie. You know, she was a real feminist of the 1970s. But she joined the movie because she wanted to be with John. You know, he didn't have much time left. His health was really deteriorating, and she was taking care of him. And because of that, she wound up in this incredible film that earned her her first Oscar nomination.
You know, I was hoping somehow, Michael, maybe you had Nick with you.
No. No. You hear anything on Nick?
No. Nothing. He's AWOL, that's all we know.
Was there something within doing that film that clicked with her to say, yes, this is the work that I want to do?
I'm not sure it did. She was really skeptical throughout filming about the movie. I think she kind of tolerated it. She thought it was, you know, she was interested in the work, but she really believed that she was going to go on and be a theater actress. You know, even in 1979, when she was becoming really famous all over for her movie work, she kept saying that her dream was to form a Shakespeare repertory company and travel across the country. And it's so interesting to see how she just resisted this idea of her being a movie star. I think part of her just didn't believe it. You know, she was always insecure about her beauty. She didn't see herself as someone who could be a Hollywood star. Right until she really, really, really took off, she just didn't believe that that's what she was fated to do.
After The Deer Hunter, what were the films that really set her on a path to the point of no return, really?
It was really Kramer versus Kramer.
But I don't know how anybody can possibly believe that I have less of a stake in mothering that little boy than Mr. Kramer does. I'm his mother. I'm his mother.
And that's what my book culminates with. It's such an incredible movie. And that was the movie that got her her first Oscar win. She was on the cover of Newsweek, being hailed as the star for the 80s. Her performance in Kramer vs. Kramer really just put her in this pantheon with the other actors of her generation, like De Niro and Pacino, Dustin Hoffman. You know, she was now just in this, talked about in the same breath as all of them, and there was really no turning back. And at the same time, she met her husband, Don Gummer, and had her first child, and I think her priorities changed. So she suddenly found movies to be the place where she belonged, and all but gave up theater very quickly.
And you point out that right after Kramer versus Kramer, the films that were mapped out for her right after that were Sophie's Choice and Silkwood. And I believe you say in the book that it would be a long time before anybody would think of her in a comedy.
Yeah, it's true. She became the sort of leading dramatic actress of these 1980s epics like Out of Africa and Sophie's Choice and all these really serious movies. And it would be a while before she was able to show her comedic chops in movies. However, one thing that I found researching this book is that she had always done comedy. She had this incredible range the whole time. And, you know, her big breakout role at the Yale School of Drama was in an absurdist comedy called The Idiot's Karamazov, where she played a crazy old, like, hag in a wheelchair with a wart on her nose. So this was always something that she could do, but for some reason, the first 10 years of her movie career, she was sort of pigeonholed as this serious, dramatic leading lady.
By Hollywood standards, she, and I think even as her biographer, you look at her story, it is not crazy. It is not overly gossipy. It is rather that of a story of a person who is very determined.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I didn't set out to try to unveil some sort of scandalous life that she had.
But does she have that life?
No, I think I think there's other things that are interesting about her. You know,
yeah.
To me, she's a great American artist. And yet we know very little bit about her and what sort of fed her intellectually, creatively, spiritually, as she was becoming the actress that we all know now. And I find that, in fact, this sort of insane praise that everyone heaps on her, all these titles like Greatest Living Actress, it kind of obscures her, you know, puts her on a pedestal. And I wanted to just explore, okay, who is this, you know, was she ever just this 20-something, you know, trying to find her way in the world, a working actress in New York City, trying to figure out, you know, what mattered to her. And, you know, there's incredible heartbreak in that story. You know, there are these two back-to-back love stories, the tragic one with John Cazale and the sort of redemptive one with Don Gummer, who she married 6 months after he died, after John died. I mean, that's just an incredible story. So I think it was actually a very eventful time in her life and a really formative one.
You mentioned Kramer versus Kramer. When you look at this period, is that really the film where you can see the culmination of that decade of work and what a fine actress she is?
Absolutely. And part of it had to do with her discovery of feminism, which is a big theme in the book. You know, right. She came of age in this time of Gloria Steinem and Ms. Magazine and consciousness-raising groups. And, you know, and yet she struggled to find roles, especially in movies that weren't, you know, the girlfriend, the sex object, the sort of dream girl, love interest. You know, she was never interested in that, in being an ingenue. And that was sort of her problem with The Deer Hunters, that she thought that's who she was being cast as. But then Kramer versus Kramer was the first time where I think she was really able to wed her belief system with her acting abilities, because that movie was so slanted originally against her character, Joanna. And she was able to really find this empathetic, complicated way of playing, you know, the would-be villain in a way that really flipped the story on its head and made you sympathize with her and made you want to understand who she was. And that, I think, is why she won the Academy Award for that movie and why people suddenly really felt, wow, this is someone with a singular talent.
Do you think she'll ever return to stage?
Well, she has rarely. She's done two little stints at Shakespeare in the Park in the last 10 or 12 years. And I saw the last one, Mother Courage and Her Children, which was unbelievable. You know, it was such an epic. She carried around a wooden shack on her shoulder. It was just amazing. But I don't think she's eager to do it. And I think part of it is because the expectations are so high. You know, how does the greatest living actress, you know, greatest actress of her generation, three-time Oscar winner, come back and, you know, headline a Broadway show or something? I think it sort of spooks her.
Well, the name of the book is Her Again, Becoming Meryl Streep. It is published by Harper. Michael Shulman, pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing with us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book, Her Again, Becoming Meryl Streep, by Michael Shulman, published by Harper. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.